requiring a federal remedy. To hear all of this, it would seem congressional staff's a good candy. Dates for the next leading example of the arrogance of irresponsible. This means that some of the most important legislation affecting our foreign and domestic policies, our most sensitive relations with the Soviet Union, the Arab world, and even world peace itself is being devised, drafted, and promoted by the same congressional staffers who are UN. Finally, the ballot box itself is a source of power. Jews vote in numbers far out of proportion to their percentage of population. This is not only due to the fact that the vast majority of Jews vote, but to the fact that a far lesser percentage of non-Jews exercise their franchise. The eight states where Jews are most concentrated: California, Maryland, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Florida are big electoral vote states where the Jewish vote can be an Israeli diplomat claims. President Ford's defeat on November 2, 1976, can be attributed to his reassessment of U.S. policy toward the Mideast. In 1975, when he squeezed us to make concessions to the Arabs. Many Jews have not forgotten that offer given. The diplomat points out that a small shift to Mr. Ford in voting among the 2 million Jews in New York City would have reversed the election result in New York State, and the umbrella organization for lobbying for the Jewish state in this country is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. AIPAC coordinates its activities with other Jewish organizations, such as the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League of Bnei Brith. AIPAC works to influence Congress and the executive branch on issues of importance to Israel, such matters as the Middle East problem and economic and military aid, the Arab boycott, and Soviet Jews' emigration. A Senate staff member says that AIPAC has a strong grassroots operation that can deliver letters and phone calls to members of Congress from their home states. At any given moment, it can mobilize. Thus, we have a situation where Israel can exert almost irresistible political influence upon the Congress and executive branch of the U.S. government by mobilizing Americans, from the grassroots to the highest levels of government, in support of its policies, even when these policies are against the best interests of the U.S. and its citizens, and, in fact, against the best interests of Israel itself. The farm lobby is obviously no match for the Israeli lobby when an American farmer's ability to sell his glut of grain to Russia depends on the number of Jews allowed to emigrate from the Soviet Union, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. Nor is the business lobby any match for the Israeli lobby when the proposed rules and regulations, under which an American company can carry on trade with friendly Arab countries, are being drafted by the Anti-Defamation League of the Bnei Brith. This matter is discussed later in the chapter, entitled The Arab Boycott. The extraordinary effectiveness of the Israeli lobby is a classic in the use of power politics. Its performances in the election year 1976 was awesome. Throughout the campaign, both presidential candidates, Carter and Ford, desperately tried to outpromise each other in concessions to Israel. The humiliating spectacle of the President of the US, within 10 days of Election Day, suddenly bypassing the objections of the Defense Department, and announcing that the US would provide Israel with the ultra-modern CBU-72 anti-personnel bombs, infra-night vision devices, M60 tanks and artillery, the approval for all of which had previously been withheld by the military, seems to be taken for granted as part of the American political scene. Within the same week, President Ford also ignominiously abandoned the administration's position on the Arab boycott and capitulated to the Israeli lobby, which had coerced a frightened Congress into imposing tax penalties on American companies who were honestly trying to do business with the Arab countries. It is no wonder that Israel's foreign minister, Yigal Allon, after watching the presidential debates on TV, is reported as saying, "I don't know if Carter or Ford won. All I know is that Israel won." In the chapter, entitled Jewish Power, of his book Jews and American Politics, author Isaac exults in the newfound ability of the Jewish community to influence political events in America. With unprecedented vigor, they brashly and openly spoke up for their fellow Jews in Israel, bombarding the White House and Congress with telegrams, letters, and calls insisting that America continue its staunch support of Israel. Heedless of whether they might seem to the goyim to be causing too much trouble, Isaacs goes further to say, The Jews' new confidence in their Americanism and in their use of these tools was spelled out quite specifically. For instance, in an article in the February 1974 issue of the National Jewish Monthly, a publication of Nabrief. The article, by Franklin R. Sibley, a congressional aide, blatantly called Jewish contributors' attention to Jews' friends and enemies who were up for election in 1974. One-third of the Senate comes up for re-election this coming fall. Among them are vigorous friends of Jewish causes. A few senators consistently opposed to Jewish concerns are also up for re-election. Foremost among these is J.W. Fulbright, D.A.R.C., who has lent respectability to the Arab cause, and given it a voice in the Senate it never enjoyed before. A believer in détente with the Soviets to the detriment of Israel's interests, he has labored diligently against legislation offered by Henry M. Jackson, D. Wash, linking preferential trade terms to the relief of Soviet Jerry. Other members of the Senate seeking re-election this year who chose not to sponsor the Jackson Amendment are Henry L. Bellman, R. Ockler, and Gaylord Nelson. D. Wiss, emphasis supplied. One cannot fail to be struck by the irony of this quoted statement. The new confidence of the Jews in their Americanism is demonstrated by an enemies list. They call for the defeat of Senator Fulbright because he is a believer in détente with the Soviet Union to the detriment of Israel's interests. Nothing is said about whether détente, a creation of Henry Kissinger, might be in America's interest. Senator Fulbright was attacked and defeated for re-election because he lent respectability to the Arab cause and a voice in the Senate it never had before. The enormous and acknowledged influence of the Israeli lobby is sometimes rationalized by saying that everybody in America has a lobby, and therefore Jews have the American right to use whatever muscle they can muster toward their special interests. What is lost sight of in this argument is that we are not talking about a Jewish lobby, but an Israeli lobby. In the past, the Jewish lobby has, in fact, functioned appropriately as a lobby, that is, in supporting civil rights causes, opposing school prayers, promoting liberal abortion laws, opposing capital punishment, and other liberal positions. In doing so, it has operated as a legitimate special interest group in American society. However, in the past 20 or more years, the Jewish lobby for the most part has become the Israeli lobby, which has become involved in matters transcending domestic issues and politics. Indeed, and we emphasize again, its principal thrust and orientation has been toward the support, by any means, of the policies of the government of Israel regardless of the best interests of the US, its allies, or that of world peace or, for that matter, the best interests of the Israeli people. The taboo. There is a second and even more crucial distinction between the Israeli lobby and the typical lobby. If one disagrees with or opposes the farm lobby, for example, he is free to say so. He can write his congressman, send a letter to the editor, march on Washington, or write a book. No such freedom exists in America so far as opposition to Israeli policy or the Israeli lobby is concerned. It is simply taboo. To do so, automatically exposes one to being branded anti-Semitic, a fascist, a Nazi, or part of the lunatic fringe. Prudent people simply will not take such a risk. Thus the effectiveness of the highly vocal and articulate Israeli partisans is multiplied by the fact that they operate in a vacuum of opposition. The following example will illustrate what is meant by this. Assume, for instance, that a congressman has received 1,000 letters on the subject of immigration restrictions on Soviet Jerry, and assume further that 975 of these letters urge the congressman to support the legislation, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, while only 25 urge non-support. If the congressman is naive, he might consider this response as an accurate reflection of the opinions of his constituency. On the other hand, in all probability, he would recognize that the 975 supporters are mostly Jewish and prompted by an organized campaign, and thus not a true sample of the views of the electorate. However, the fact that only 25 non-Jews wrote at all would seem to indicate to the congressman that the vast majority of his constituents who did not write were indifferent, and that only the Jews felt strongly enough to write. But in this assumption, the congressman would be dead wrong. he would have failed to take into consideration the known fact that most Americans had become so conditioned and intimidated by the taboo